Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Community Matters here on 103.7 WEEI. I'm your host, Scott Cordici. Glad you could join us. Community Matters is the show that comes your way each and every Saturday morning and keeps you up to date and in touch with many of the great things that are happening in and around our communities here in the state of Rhode Island, in eastern Connecticut, and in southeastern Massachusetts. And this morning, it gives us great pleasure to welcome back to the program the president and founder of the World War II Foundation, former NBC 10 sports anchor Tim Gray is with us. Tim, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Scott. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Tim. Always great to catch up with you.
Yeah, and definitely.
It's been a little while, but I think it's appropriate that we speak to you with this being Memorial Day weekend. Let's start with this, Tim. We have changing audiences, as you know, so maybe the people that heard you on the show a year or two ago, they may not be listening right now. We may have an entirely new audience. So why don't you explain
to— Where are you going with this, Scott? Where are you going with
it? I want you to explain to people what the World War II Foundation is and what it's all about.
We are a foundation that primarily does documentary films on World War II, and we've done about 40 films for American Public Television and PBS, all narrated by different celebrities, everyone from a former Patriots head coach named Bill Belichick to Luke Bryan and Darius Rucker. Jim Nance of CBS Sports does a lot of our films, Gary Sinise. So the films air around the United States, and then they air globally after that. And then we have a museum down in South Kingstown, Rhode Island, that is considered the most comprehensive collection in the United States of World War II artifacts. It's not the biggest, it's not the best, but we touch on all aspects of the war with about 7,000 artifacts that we have down there. So those are the primary two things that we do as a foundation: the films, and then having this museum, the International Museum of World War II. So we're trying to fill in a gap in schools. A lot of schools don't teach World War II anymore. So a lot of the students who come and visit the museum, that's their first taste of experiencing probably the most defining period in the history of the world. So that's what we do in a short nutshell.
You know, and one of the ways you do differentiate yourself, you talk about the documentaries that you produce, and I've seen a couple of them myself, and they're fabulous. And you're not producing World War II films, you're producing documentaries on personal stories from individuals that were in World War II, correct?
Yeah. I mean, we take about a 5,000 foot view of the war. We don't get heavy into dates and battle strategy and things like that. We try to get the personal stories of the men and the women who were involved, the witnesses, the survivors. And so that's a different view. It's not about necessarily why the war was fought, or we touch on that, but we don't get into the weeds too much. It's more of just the personal stories that these men and women went through and how they experienced the war, whether they were in combat or Rosie the Riveter on the home front or were in a concentration camp in Poland. So we find that for younger audiences, especially, the personal stories resonate much more than dates and treaties and battle plans.
Tell us what made you want to do this, Tim. I think people listening to this station, a lot of them, myself included, remember you as a sports anchor here in the Providence market at Channel 10. And, you know, now here you are starting up this World War II Foundation. You're producing wonderful documentaries. What gave you this idea? What made you want to do this?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I was about six when I picked up my first World War II book and was just hooked on the stories. And then throughout, you know, my young life, I was always reading and watching documentaries, The World at War and all those things that were around. And then I followed my brother. My brother was a television sportscaster and he's 10 years older. So I kind of followed him into the field, wondering whether I'd like it or not. And I liked it. I didn't love it. I love what I do now. I think it's a combination of writing about something I've always been interested in my entire life and something that's really, really important. And then like you, it's like you love to write. You know, I mean, I think there are people who are just born to write and they just enjoy writing, and that's the way they express themselves. So to be able to take the journalism part, which I did for 15 years, and just bring it to a new medium, documentaries, with something that I really, really, really have always been interested in, just kind of was a good marriage. So it's worked out well.
And how cool has it been to deal with and look, there are now very few probably living members that fought in World War II, but how cool is it to talk to these men and women, arguably the greatest generation that this country has ever seen, and hear their stories and see how appreciative they are of you listening to their story and in many cases telling their story.
They are very humble for a generation that can claim to have saved the world. There's no other generation around that can make that claim that they saved the world. And they did it in such a humble manner and then came back and, rebuilt their lives and rebuilt the country. And they did it with so much humility. And if you try to call them a hero, they'll kick you in the knee. And they came back with a lot of survivor's guilt too, because a lot of the people who were their friends are buried in overseas cemeteries all over the world. So I think they came back as just people who wanted to get on with their lives. But if there's anybody who at the Warwick Mall should be wearing a shirt that says, "I'm famous, I saved the world," it's that generation. But they've never lived their lives based on likes or clicks, or they just wanted to win World War II as a job and go on with their lives. So to sit with them, you learn a lot. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about them. You learn a lot about that time period. So it's been a huge education for me and for any time we get to sit down with a veteran. There were about 16 million Americans who served in World War II, and today there are about 60,000 left, and that number is dwindling very fast. And most of them are 99 or 100. And you look at them and they're old men now, but man, they were pretty amazing when they were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old and saving the world at that age. I mean, I was still, I think, sucking my thumb when I was 20 years old. I couldn't imagine landing on Omaha Beach or Iwo Jima or a place like that when I was a teenager. And that's what they did.
And through your travels and talking to these great men and women, I kind of take it from our last conversation too. It's nice to see that they are appreciated by so many for all that they did to, as you put it simply, to save the world. And I think a great tribute to that is all of the famous people that you've gotten to narrate these films, right? I'm sure they want to do it for that very reason, because they're so proud of these people in this generation and what they did for us. And to get Jim Nantz and Bill Belichick and Tom Selleck and Dan Aykroyd, everybody that you've gotten, that kind of shows the magnitude of the impact that these people had on all of us.
A lot of those people too are related in some way to somebody who's been in the military, or they played in a military-related movie or television series. So there's an appreciation there. Jim Nantz's son-in-law is a fighter pilot with the Navy. I mean, Gary Sinise obviously does so much with veterans. Tom Selleck was in the National Guard in the early 1970s. So, Kevin Bacon was in A Few Good Men. So they have this appreciation for not only the military, but especially that generation. So it's been great to work with them. I joke with my wife, it's kind of like, you're driving down in through Wakefield and you get a phone call and it's Dan Aykroyd, and it's like trading places, or it's like, "Tim, it's Dan Aykroyd," and I'm like, "Yeah, okay, it's Dan Aykroyd calling me on my car phone and my cell phone, and he sounds like Dan Aykroyd." So it's you have to pull over, keep from laughing. But those moments are great. And one of the other things that we do, Scott, is we shoot all of our films on location. So if we're doing a film, let's say on Auschwitz, or we're doing a film on Guadalcanal, we go back to these places today to see what the environment looks like. And a lot of the times, especially in the Pacific, the environment hasn't changed at all. There's just more jungle that's grown up, but all the tools of war are still there, the crashed Japanese Zeros and tanks and live grenades and everything. So it's interesting to be able to go back and step back in time like that.
You mentioned something a moment ago that really struck a chord with me in that, many schools unfortunately aren't teaching about World War II any longer. And one of my favorite classes in high school was a class called The World at War. And I remember my teacher, Herm Diehl, God rest his soul. He was just wonderful. But like you, I was so intrigued by and interested in it and all the stories, which you are doing a great job of conveying. But you talked about trying to make this accessible to teachers, right? They can schedule class tours of your museum. And I think you have resources for them on your website and elsewhere, correct?
Yeah, we actually pick up the cost of all the school buses that come. A lot of the public schools now, busing is privatized, so even when they want to go on a field trip, it costs $300 or $400 just for them to rent the bus to go on the field trip. So a lot of the times that's a no right from the get-go for principals and others. So we pick up the cost of the school bus. And we bring them to the museum, and usually they've heard of World War II through like Call of Duty video games or something, but most of them, have no clue that somebody in their family is probably connected to World War II in some way or not. But it's just interesting when they come in, we probably had 4,500, 4,800 students through since we opened, and there hasn't been one kid who's been disinterested. There hasn't been one student who's been in the corner on their phone. They've all been into it. And we always kid the teachers and say, wow, if you can get a reaction like this from your students, you might want to teach this a little bit more in school. So yeah, it's just, it's great to have the young people come in and take an interest in Pearl Harbor or D-Day or the Holocaust or something. It's just, you hope they'll go home and Google, December 7th, 1941, or World War II, and there's a lot they can learn from those people from that generation. Overcoming adversity is probably the biggest one for these students. We always tell them these men and women who were around during World War II grew up in the Great Depression. They were already behind the eight ball.
Yeah.
Their parents probably lost their job. So they've overcome a lot. And if you want to learn about overcoming adversity, go talk to that 99-year-old.
Yeah. Tim, earlier this week, on May 21st, you held an event at the International Museum of World War II, a discussion with someone who was born in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. Can you talk to us a little bit about that event? That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's an overlooked part of the history. It was Executive Order 9066 that was signed into law by Roosevelt, and it was mostly because of the paranoia after Pearl Harbor. Japanese Americans, the Nisei, second generation Americans, Japanese Americans who were born in the United States, were rounded up in Hawaii, but mostly on the West Coast in California, and sent to internment camps where they wrote out the war. They were looked at as potential spies and everything else, but they were very loyal Americans. In fact, a lot of those younger men who were in the camps offered to fight in World War II and were sent to Europe as part of the 442nd Nisei Regiment, and they were the highest decorated regiment in all of Europe in World War II. And these were Japanese Americans fighting the Germans and Italians while their families were being held in these internment camps back in the United States. So it was not a shining example of Roosevelt's best hour when he did that, but it was also a reflection of the paranoia going on in a time when there wasn't much communication and rumors and myths and all these things spread like wildfire. So it was just an interesting time. And it was so interesting, in fact, that Steven Spielberg did a comedy movie, believe it or not. It wasn't so much based on the Nisei, but about the paranoia during World War II. And it was called 1941. Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi were in that, and a lot of other folks. But it was based on a true story that everyone thought the Japanese were parachuting into California and were going to invade the United States. And just the paranoia that ran wild during that time, which led to people like Ken, who spoke at the museum in front of a great sold-out crowd, talking about his experience as a Japanese American. And again, it was not something that it was probably the worst decision of Roosevelt's presidency, but it was also based on the paranoia of the times.
Any other upcoming events that you want to talk about, and events that might be coming up in June, July, August, etc.?
Things kind of pop up. Nothing really set in stone at this point. We've got some film stuff coming up and travel and things like that in France and other parts of the world, shooting some new documentaries that we're excited about. Paul Giamatti is going to narrate one, and John Malkovich is going to do another. We're working to finish up a documentary with Keith Morrison at Dateline right now. If you know that voice, it's going to be interesting to hear Keith do that. And Jim Nance is narrating another film for us. So, just kind of juggling crocodiles right now.
Tim, how is the World War II Foundation supported?
We are supported through personal donations, corporate sponsorships. I mean, just I spent the last 20 years as one of those golfers, Scott, that you can relate to, who just grinds. You don't have the talent of Tiger Woods, so you're out there just grinding off the tee. You're into the right rough, and then you're into a bunker, and then somehow you make par. So that's what we've done for 20 years. You're just trying to appeal to people that these important stories should be preserved and seen, not just preserved, but seen by people. It's one thing to preserve a story, but if it's not being seen, it's not doing any good. So we have a national and global audience for the films, and that's helped with some donors and sponsors.
And the best thing for people to do is go to your website, right? WWIIFoundation.org. There they can learn about your foundation. There they can donate. There they can visit the online shop, see information about events and other things.
Yeah, and all of our films are up there for free. We make all of our films available on our website for free for educators and students and the public. And we also have a global app that people can download on their smart TVs or phones and things like that, where all of our films are free.
In terms of the museum itself in South Kingstown, are there hours? Do people have to schedule visits? How does that work?
We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5. So they don't have to schedule, make an appointment, only if they're coming down in a large group. But it's usually busiest during the summer with the tourists and everything. It's starting to pick up now. But yeah, just Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, come on down. And it's really a great museum. And the museum's set up like our films. It's the personal stories from the war.
And then last thing, for people listening that might have had, a grandmother, a grandfather, or someone that fought in World War II, and maybe they're sitting on some World War II artifacts. Is that something that you're always looking for? If people say, hey, geez, what can I do with this old army helmet or what have you? Should they reach out to you?
Yeah, we always encourage people to offer those artifacts to family members first. And if the son or granddaughter doesn't want them, we'll be happy to put them on display and also do a write-up and attach that write-up to the veteran where the artifacts came from. So it gives people a personal story to go along with the helmet or the uniform or something. And so it's, we get quite a few donations, mostly uniforms and things like that, but people just can't stand the throwaway dad or grandpa's uniform because
Right.
it represents such an important part of history.
Absolutely. And the best thing to do for contact information, go to the website WWIIFoundation.org. It's the World War II Foundation. President and founder Tim Gray has been our guest this morning. Tim, thanks so much as always for joining us. Really appreciate it. Appropriate that we catch up on Memorial Day as we remember all the great men and women that lost their lives in service of this great country that we live in.
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure.
Tim Gray, our guest here on Community Matters. My thanks to Tim for joining us. Also want to thank producer Laura Minicucci, and most of all, thanks to all of you for tuning in. My name is Scott Kredisci. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, everybody.
Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Community Matters with your host, Scott Kredisci. If your group or organization would like to be part of the show, email us at communitymatters@weei.com.